Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt. Welcome to the interview with Hugh Hewitt, sponsored by AndrewandTodd.com. Andrew and Todd are with Sierra Pacific Mortgage. They help you with all your real estate lending needs. If you're refinancing your home, if you're buying a new home, if you're a senior who wants a reverse mortgage, or if you're a veteran who doesn't want to put any money down, whatever it is, if you're in the private real estate market for yourself, and maybe you want an investment property, try AndrewandTodd.com or call 888-888-1172. Now on to the interview with Hugh Hewitt.
You'll be back soon, you'll see. You remember you belong to me. You'll be back, time will tell. You remember that I served you well. Oceans rise, empires fall. We have seen each other through it all. And when push comes to shove, I will send a fully armed battalion to remind you of my love. Da,
da, da. Welcome back, America. If you don't know George III from Hamilton, I don't know what cave you've been living in. It's a memorable moment if you've ever seen the stage play. And now that character comes alive in his fullness in a brand new magisterial biography of him entitled The Last King of America, The Misunderstood Reign of George III, which I'm holding in my hand if you're watching on the Salem News Channel, by eminent historian and friend Andrew Roberts. He's back. Andrew, welcome back to the show. Congratulations. What a magnificent book.
You are so kind, Hugh. Thank you very much. And, of course, my toe was tapping just as much as everybody else at Lin-Manuel Miranda's song, even though historically, as I'm sure you'll appreciate, I don't think it's accurate.
No, I got that early on. As you say, as he prances onto the stage, George III, comic but cruel, camp but sinister, difficult to do, done to perfection, and simply not true. And what I think The Last King of America does, and I've never even considered this, is give us a portrait of him in the round.
Well, that's the idea, certainly, yes. I mean, the three things that people know about him, that he had porphyria, that his madness and his obstinacy led to the American Revolution, and, of course, that he was a tyrant, I think all three of those things are completely untrue. And so it was an exciting book. I was very fortunate that Her Majesty the Queen allowed 100,000 pages of material on George III to come into the public domain, and it really does show a completely different picture from the one that you get in Hamilton the Musical, and indeed the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, it does. Andrew Roberts, I listened to your books ever since Jim Sassoni told me I needed to listen to Napoleon, and I did. I am listening to The Last King of America, and according to my Apple phone, it tells me I've listened to 38% of it thus far. So I'm up to about the start of the war. So I'm going to focus on the first 38% of the book, and then because I love every bit. But I want to start with an unusual part. You put your acknowledgments up front, and so I'm listening. And up pops Lady Antonia Fraser, who I confess I did not know was still alive. And you thank her for her efforts.
She's very much still alive. She came to, I'm president of the Clifton Literary Festival, and she came and spoke there 2 weeks ago. So I assure you, she's very much alive.
Well, I looked her up as soon as I heard that, and I said, well, bravo, because, you know, I read Cromwell like four decades ago, yeah, and Mary Queen of Scots, yeah, five decades ago. So you really had the help of the, yes, best of the best.
She's really one of our finest historians, and still very much on the writing circuit.
I'm so glad to hear that, and I'm glad you got to talk to her and have her help. Now, there's an old Quaker saying that an enemy is a friend whose story you haven't heard yet. And I think many people will consider that about George III when they make their way through. Let's begin with the fact his grandfather's a wretched man. Would you tell people what a wretched man George II was?
George II was evil, in my view. I mean, tremendously sinister figure. He hated his son so much that when his son, Frederick, Prince of Wales, George III's father, died, he wouldn't allow him to be buried. So the putrefying and decomposing corpse of the Prince of Wales was left in the room above this poor 12-year-old young prince's bedroom, which is pretty much the par for the course for him. He was thrilled when his son died. And then after that, he was horrible to his grandson as well, poor old George III.
Yeah, he struck him so hard at Hampton Court that he never went back. It's really quite an amazing thing. However, what I learned is George III had amazing tutors towards the end, and he wrote essays. And I gather you got your hands on the original essays. As a student, is it 8,500 pages of essays?
Yes, it is. And it is extraordinary, the stuff that he was writing. I mean, for example, when he was Prince of Wales in the 1750s, he wrote an article on Montesquieu's Essays on the Laws, in which he took to pieces every one of the arguments in favor of slavery. Have you got time for one sentence?
Oh, we got lots of time.
Can I read you a sentence? Have you read?
Please.
He said, what shall we say for a European traffic in black slaves? The very reasons urged for it will be perhaps sufficient to make us hold such practice in execration for an inhuman custom wantonly practiced by the most enlightened polite nations in the world. There is no occasion to answer them, for they stand self-condemned. And this is a man who never bought or sold a slave in his life, who never invested in any of the companies that did that, and, of course, who signed the abolition of the slave trade in 1807, signed the legislation, you know. And yet he's held up to be sort of somehow morally inferior to the founding fathers.
Well, I think I know what Rick Atkinson, who George W. Bush recommended I read his book, The British Are Coming, so I did. If you just read The British Are Coming, your opinion will be like mine, that he is a tyrant. In fact, he's not a tyrant. As you write in The Last King of America, he's an Enlightenment monarch. And I think people need to take that away. He's in love with Blackstone. I think you say his worship of the British Constitution almost constitutes idolatry. He's such a musical aficionado, and he can play four or five instruments. He played with Bach's son. He invited Haydn to stay. This is a cultured, educated man, and we're going to come to what he got wrong about America. But expand on that, Andrew, because it's a revelation to me.
Yes, although Thomas Paine called him the royal brute of Britain, here's a man who set up the Royal Academy, who bought half of the royal collection, the largest art collection in the world today, who had his books, 80,000 of his books of his library form the center, the kernel of the British Library today. He was fascinated by science. The planet Uranus was named after him because he helped buy the biggest telescope in the world. He was a great supporter of architecture, the neoclassical Georgian school of architecture. And, of course, as you say, I mean, Haydn he tried to bring to Britain, but also Handel said that he was, whilst this boy lives, I need no other protector, Handel said. And he brought Mozart to Buckingham Palace to play as well. So, you know, the idea of him being a royal brute is monstrous, frankly.
Well, you mentioned that many Americans have a point of view that depends upon the madness of King George or the Declaration of Independence, and you're working hard against this. Now, you are an Englishman, so, of course, you may be trying to deal the right hand here, so we're going to have to adjust for the lie of the green, but I'm very impressed by his encouragement of piety and virtue in the prevention and punishment of vice, profaneness, and immorality. At another point, you tell us that you suspect an account of him swearing is not true because of his piety, but you don't. I haven't yet gotten to the full explanation of his religious view. Is he completely sold out to the Church of England in more than a political way? Is he a deep believer?
Yeah, no, he's a true believer. Yes, he had a strong Christian faith. He both obviously attended church a lot, but also truly believed in it. He enjoyed talking to bishops much more than to politicians and indeed anyone else. His Christian faith was very central to his whole persona.
This is such a strange world to live in. I personally want to become the keeper of the fire bucket in the next presidential administration. But I also would take the job of backgammon player to His Majesty, because they evidently had a couple of designated. He seems like a kindly man who goes about incognito, like the prince and the pauper, dealing with people.
That's right. Yes, chatting to them about their interests. You know, he was nicknamed Farmer George because he liked nothing more than to wander around the country incognito, as you say, because they didn't dress up like the Bourbons in Versailles. They dressed as normal sort of English country gentlemen and liked talking about, you know, the cost of pigs and things. He wrote articles in agricultural magazines about crop rotation and manure and things like that. Which so you have to remember, of course, 80% of people had their drew their livelihoods from agriculture. So it was an important way to know what the people were doing and thinking.
After the break, I'm going to set the table for people about the war, but I want to stay for a moment about England when he becomes the king. The colonial administrator, Lord Macartney, says this vast empire on which the sun never sets, that is coined during the time of King George. He doesn't say it. So he is in complete command of the largest empire everywhere, and he's perfectly trained for it. So set the table, Andrew. What goes wrong? Is it William Pitt? Is it Grenville? What goes wrong to send him skittering off on the wrong direction on the colonies?
Well, what goes wrong is that by the 1760s and 1770s, America is ripe and ready for self-government. It's the right thing for America. It's got 2.5 million people. It's got a burgeoning economy that's growing at about 6% a year. It's got more bookshops in Philadelphia than any other city of the empire apart from London. And it has no outside threats because the French have been flung off the North African continent by the Treaty of Paris in 1763. So it's ripe for self-government.
So, Andrew, what I don't understand, since he read Blackstone, and I'm a lawyer and I've been teaching con law, there's a concept called estoppel. And it seems to me that George III ought to have recognized he was estopped from reclaiming the self-government that England had long given to the colonies. We had grown used to running our own affairs, and he did not want us to do that anymore.
No, that's not true. He really wanted you to run your own affairs, but what he also wanted was for you to be able to help, in a very small way, offset the enormous costs that the French and Indian War came to. All he wanted with the Stamp Act was for £40,000 to £50,000, which between 2.5 million Americans, or at least 1.9 million unslaved Americans, was not a lot of money. It was something like 2 shillings and 6 pence.
Well, you walked through the math in The Last King. Wait. You walked through the math in The Last King, and you said that the Lord that did that calculation underestimated how much was paid and overestimated how many were paying. So it was actually kind of a significant deal for some of the people who got involved in the revolution that George wanted that money, right?
Well, he made the big mistake of irritating of the land, the actual taxes landed on journalists and on lawyers, and they are the noisiest people in society, as you know.
As I prove every day, yes.
You don't pick a fight with people who buy ink by the barrel. It was a remark of the 19th century, and unfortunately he did exactly that. But every penny of that tax that was being raised, or what they wanted to raise, the stamp tax, was going to be spent in America protecting Americans.
All right, before we go to break, the first episode of The Illness, I never knew this, occurred in 1765. Would you give us the précis of the illness that you believe is correct? Because up till 2016, everyone thought it was the other thing, and now you're saying it's not.
That's right. They all thought that it was porphyria, but the as my appendix points out in this at the end of this book, actually that comes as a result of some really terrible misleading symptoms that back in the 1960s, a mother and her son medical team gave to doctors, and they wound up with this diagnosis, which of course was picked up by Alan Bennett in the play and Nicholas Heitner in the movie, and has been believed until, as you say, 2016, when now all the medical opinion, all the top people recognize that in fact it was bipolar disorder type affective one, and it was not porphyria.
I'll be right back with Andrew Roberts. Go get his book, The Last King of America. You will love it. Go listen to it. That's what I believe you ought to do. I'm listening to it, and it's wonderfully read, and it's absolutely entrancing. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt with Andrew Roberts, and this is part one of a two-parter with Andrew. I'm going to have him back when I'm finished with the book, because I've only listened to 40% of it, so that I can ask him a lot. I'm going to hear you tomorrow night, Andrew, by the way, and I'm not going to lug the hard copy with me to get it signed, although someday I'm going to get all your Andrew Roberts books signed. But my gosh, this is good. I want to go to the central reveal of the first 40% of the book. George III was the victim of bad intelligence. There were 17, exactly 17, I believe you write, colonial officials in Virginia at the beginning of the decade of decision. And in 1770, I'm quoting from memory here, a consensus existed among the establishment of Great Britain, crown, bishops, Commons and Lords, that a small group of radicals in the United States was not a threat that could be subdued completely and quickly. That is bad intel. Is that a good and fair summary of the situation in 1769 to 70?
Yes, it's very very accurate. And the intel he was getting came from the royal governors of the 13 provinces, later the states. So, they were the people on the ground, the kind of people whose sole job it was really to keep the king and the government properly informed. And they managed to get it completely wrong. And the thing that they got most wrong was that all of the provinces would stick together, that they would act as a team, united, which all the royal governors thought that they would split up and be able to be picked off one by one.
Now, the key thing is Jim Zucconi got me to read Napoleon. I've got to get Americans to read The Last King of America. I believe it's going to sell so well because of Churchill and Napoleon before that. What do the early returns tell you about the willingness of the American people to be educated about their last king?
Hugely impressive so far, but it is only 2 days into a 5-week book tour of 5 states. So it's best to probably ask me this next time we talk. Once you read the book, we'll talk again, and I'll give you a much better idea about whether people are listening to what I have to say.
The Last King is available at Amazon.com. People, it's the perfect Christmas present. Go get it for your dad or your grandma or your grandpa or anyone who loves long history books and needs to read. And get it for your kids because it's such an introduction to England in 1770. Let me get a preview from you. And you know where I am. I'm at 1770, and I'll be done the next time you come back. There's a lot of cruelty in Tarleton and others. Is George III aware of the cruelty of the Hessians and the cruelty of his men and what became a guerrilla war? Did he know that?
No, he wasn't kept informed properly by the generals about the outrages that happened. On both sides, I think it's fair to say the loyalists tended to be the people. The Hessians are blamed for a lot of this. In fact, the loyalists who formed about a third of Americans in 1776. They were responsible for an awful lot of atrocities. And it has to be said, the Patriots as well, who, when you get on to the burning of Norfolk, Virginia, for example, you'll see that that was done by both sides. But the idea of the king being blamed for it, as he was in two of the clauses of the Declaration of Independence, is quite fanciful because he just wasn't, he was 3,000 miles away and certainly never gave any orders for that kind of thing.
So when the British Navy reduces a coastal town in Maine to ashes, you don't attribute responsibility of that to the king?
No, I don't. I attribute it to the admiral who did it. And when you come on to Norfolk, you'll see that actually many more houses were destroyed by the Patriots than by the Loyalists and by the Royal Navy. Horrible things happen in what was essentially a civil war. I hardly need to tell you that. So there's an assumption that you have to blame the person at the top. I don't think that's right any more than I would blame George W. Bush personally for what happened in Abu Ghraib, for example.
You know, this is why I'm going to finish this by the time you come back in a couple of weeks, because I want to know an objective view of the conduct of the American Revolutionary War. But I'm also glad for a second reason that it's out, Andrew. That means you're at work on Disraeli, and that means that Disraeli should be out in a year. Am I right about that? Is Disraeli coming in a year?
It's kind of you to tease me, Hugh. You know perfectly well it's going to be at least 4 years.
No, I can't wait 4 years. I'm going to make it the best-selling biography of a non-American in American history because I love Disraeli and I love Andrew Roberts, and I know you're working on it. Are you at Hewden all the time or whatever we call his house?
Hughenden. No, the papers are at the Bodleian in Oxford, in fact. But Hughenden is a beautiful place and great fun to visit. But and that's obviously where he's buried as well. But the archives are at Oxford University.
Okay, you're going to be spending your time at the library in Oxford. Come back. I'll see you tomorrow night, Andrew Roberts, in person. I want to recommend to everybody this book I'm holding up, The Last King of America. It is entrancing. I listened to it. I think you ought to get the audiobook or get both like I did. And then give it away for Christmas. And Andrew Roberts will be back in about 3 weeks. I'll be done. with the other 60% of the book, and we'll finish up. But boy, the first up till 1770, amazing stuff. Thank you, Andrew Roberts. Thank you, Dwayne. Thank you, Generalissimo. Ben Harley. The Chris Christie interview is all at Hugh Hewitt. The interview with Hugh Hewitt. I will be back tomorrow live on the next Hugh Hewitt Show. That concludes today's episode of The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening. Make sure you come back and check out all the other podcasts on the Salem Podcast Network. And remember to thank our sponsors, AndrewandTodd.com. If you believe in long-form interviews like I do, then do your real estate transactions with Andrew Del Rey and Todd Avakian. I've known both men for a long time. AndrewandTodd.com. Go there, answer a couple of questions. They'll tell you what's best to do with your house, or call them at 888-888-1172. You'll be glad you did, and you'll be glad that you listened to the next episode of The Interview.